This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Bridget Dowd. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of August 18th, 2025. After the U.S. closed the door to asylum seekers at the beginning of President Trump's second term, many migrants who had recently traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border were left in limbo. Now some are looking to seek asylum in Mexico, but they're running up against a system that's already overwhelmed. From the Fronteras Desk, KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky reports from Nogales, Sonora.
When Jessica left her home in El Salvador last fall, her and her husband's goal was to seek asylum in the U.S.
Pues salimos del Salvador por amenazas de las pandillas.
The couple says they fled El Salvador after receiving threats from gangs, which is why we're using only their first names. After a dangerous journey on foot through Mexico that involved being kidnapped, they missed their appointment to seek asylum in the U.S. by less than 2 hours. Their January 18th appointment would have been one of the very last. Trump ended them on his first day in office 2 days later. Now, Jessica and her husband are changing their plans. They're filing a new asylum application, this time in Mexico.
Vamos a quedarnos acá. De regresar allá ya no se puede.
We're going to stay here. We can't go back to El Salvador, Jessica says. But like the thousands of other migrants who've decided to do the same since January 20th, they're up against an overwhelmed asylum system. The process could take over a year, lawyers say, much longer than the 45 business days that Mexico generally promises. In the end, there is no guarantee that the Mexican government will approve their asylum claims. Jessica and her husband have already been at this shelter in Nogales, Sonora for nearly 8 months. The sun beats down on the hilltop campus, and we find refuge under the shade of a stately tree outside the dorms.
No salimos, porque nos da miedo.
We don't leave the shelter because we're scared, she says. She fears they could be deported back to El Salvador if they try to find work. Thousands of other migrants have also filed asylum claims in Mexico this year, even as migration to the U.S.-Mexico border has plummeted since the beginning of Trump's term. The migrants who remain in Mexico face dwindling options. They could turn back to the country they left, entrust their claim to Mexico's flooded refugee system, or wait for a shift in U.S. policy. All those options come with downsides, says Daniela Ugaz, a lawyer with the Arizona-based nonprofit Florence Project, who represents asylum seekers.
It's very hard to say, like, this is clearly the better option because we're not in a world where there are good options at the moment.
The arm of the Mexican government that processes refugee claims has been overwhelmed for years, experts say. Over the past decade, it's seen ballooning numbers of asylum claims from just over 1,000 people in all of 2013 to more than 140,000 in 2023.
The first thing that I can say is that there is like an internal crisis.
Diego Ramirez Saldivar represents asylum seekers in Tijuana with the nonprofit legal service, the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants.
Mexico, it is well recognized as a pro-migration country, but unfortunately, Mexico doesn't have like the capacity to attend all of the requests.
Ramirez Saldivar says he has to regularly deliver bad news about long wait times to asylum seekers in his city who are desperate to work or study legally. Back in Nogales, Jessica and her husband have watched the shelter largely clear out. Former residents have left to find work, unable to afford to wait for an asylum claim to process. Without documents, they're vulnerable to abuse and unable to access social services.
Esta es la bandera de El Salvador.
Jessica shows me a piece of embroidery she's been working on.
Mi corazón partido en dos.
It's a heart. One crest is filled with the Salvadoran flag, the other, the U.S. flag. But even as she gets ready to stitch the stars and stripes, she and her husband are putting what was once their dream of making it to the U.S. on hold.
Quizás quiere que nos vayamos para nuestro país.
Maybe the Mexican government wants us to go back to our countries, Jessica says. But they don't know the suffering we've gone through to be where we are. For now, Jessica is trying to game out what life might look like if they're able to get refugee status here. The stress of it all keeps her up at night. But if they're successful, they'll be able to reunite with their daughter and granddaughters, who they left behind in southern Mexico when they realized how dangerous it would be to travel through the country on foot. Jessica, a cook, hopes getting refugee status could let them put down roots here in Nogales, Sonora.
Aquí no hay pupuserías. Queremos poner una pupusería.
There aren't any pupuserias here, she says. If she gets documents, she wants to open one and bring the cheesy rice flour pancakes of home to her new neighbors in Mexico. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Nogales, Sonora.
An ongoing controversy swirling around the state school voucher program has reignited an internal feud in the Arizona Republican Party, leading two GOP officials to call on party chairwoman Gina Swoboda to resign. From KJZZ's politics desk, Wayne Shutsky reports.
Following reports that families had used voucher dollars on questionable purchases like lingerie, Swoboda said she supported auditing the program to ensure the money is being spent appropriately. State Senator Jake Hoffman and former lawmaker Liz Harris, both state party officials, called on Swoboda to resign over the comments, which they say amounts to an attack on the voucher program. They claim the situation is one of several incidents proving Swoboda doesn't represent conservative values. Swoboda brushed off that criticism. She says she supports school choice for parents and called Hoffman and Harris, quote, low-rent grifters. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. The Colorado River is used by nearly 40 million people and a massive agriculture industry. Oftentimes, all that demand doesn't leave much behind for the river itself. One Native American tribe is trying to change that by giving the Colorado River the same legal rights as a person. Alex Hager has more.
In far western Arizona, the barren brown desert sprawls across hundreds of miles, except right here, where the Colorado River creates a thriving pocket of green. Dylan Esquera, a member of the Colorado River Indian Tribes, says people here have a personal relationship with the water.
When you grow up along the river, you know, your identity is tied to that. You know, your culture is tied to that. You know, your past, your history is tied to it. You know, we look at it as something that nurtures us, so we have to protect it.
And now the tribal government is turning those values into law. It's in the process of giving the river the same rights a person would have in court, the first of their kind on the Colorado.
It can show proof that this is what you believe in, this is what you stand for.
Tribal Chairwoman Amelia Flores says these protections are critical now. Arizona is short on water. The fast-growing Phoenix area is already knocking on the tribe's door asking to buy or lease some. So these protections do two things. First, they send a message. They're a way to take millennia of indigenous values and write them into a newer colonial legal system.
We want to keep that essence alive as much as we can, and if it's the essence is in this Western way of thinking, then so be it.
Personhood status could also do something practical. The tribe wants to set up a fund for the river, so anyone coming to do business would have to pay toward habitat restoration or education for younger tribal members. Flores says it's a way to flip the script on how much of the Southwest uses water.
We've taken from this river. We're not giving back. We're not being reciprocal and giving back.
This idea isn't new. Flores learned about so-called rights of nature on a trip to New Zealand with the indigenous Maori people. With examples abroad and in the U.S., there are some lessons about how this might play out on the Colorado River. Erin O'Donnell teaches water law at the University of Melbourne in Australia.
Given that it is a river like the Colorado that has been the subject of so many lawsuits and has such a complicated legal framework and extends well outside the boundaries of the Colorado River Indian tribes, I think the backlash is, it is a real issue that they will need to be aware of and navigate.
O'Donnell says making a river a legal individual is a double-edged sword. Companies or governments can push back by taking legal action against that river. But, she says,
the most successful examples of rights of nature around the world have been the ones that are indigenous-led. They tend to be the ones that get less backlash.
How exactly these new tribal laws will shape the region's management of the river is yet to be seen. But Heather Tanana says it's a step in the right direction for a river that's stretched too thin.
What has happened to date hasn't really worked. The river is still in decline.
Tanana is a member of the Navajo Nation and a law professor at the University of Denver.
We're still over-allocating, overusing, and so turning to new ideas, new tools definitely should be explored. And Rights in Nature is one of those.
But as much as this legal concept might be a new tool, Dylan Esquera says it reflects long-standing ideas from members of the Colorado River Indian tribes.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, we've always looked at the river as a person. You know, it's an entity. It's what we rely on to survive.
And here, with the birds chirping and fish flitting under the water surface, he says you can feel how the river is breathing and living. In Parker, Arizona, I'm Alex Hager.
On Friday, a federal judge in Phoenix seemingly cleared the way for a massive copper mining project until the Ninth Circuit suddenly stepped in. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piantarazio reports, the latest court order came less than 24 hours before Oak Flat inside the Tonto National Forest would have turned into private property.
That pending land exchange between the U.S. Forest Service and Resolution Copper has been put on hold once more, with a temporary administrative injunction issued Monday by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The new order comes after Judge Dominic Lanza denied requests to delay the congressionally authorized land transfer. These pleas came from plaintiffs, including the San Carlos Apache tribe. The tribe called it a last-minute victory, while Resolution Copper is confident the court will ultimately affirm Judge Lanza's, quote, well-reasoned orders. The three-judge panel noted these appeals will undergo an expedited briefing schedule starting next month. Gabriel Piantarazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Mesa Public Schools is set to cut dozens of jobs to address a projected budget shortfall as student enrollment declines. As KJZZ's Jill Ryan reports, this is in addition to staff reductions made earlier this year.
In February, 42 certified staffers were laid off and 147 district-level positions were set for elimination ahead of the new school year. Now, an organizational redesign is also underway. Mesa Schools Superintendent Matt Strom says in a video, 43 administrative and certified specialist jobs will be cut to help save more than $3 million.
In the last 3 years, our student population has decreased by nearly 3,400 students. Projections for the next 3 years show a further decline of approximately 4,900 students.
Strom says that, coupled with the low state funding and uncertainty in federal funding, there's now a projected budget shortfall of $9 to $18 million for next school year. Jill Ryan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Researchers have discovered a new moon orbiting the seventh planet from the sun, Uranus. As KJZZ's Greg Haney reports, it was founded by a University of Arizona-developed camera on the James Webb Space Telescope.
It's the 29th moon found orbiting the gas giant that is roughly 2 billion miles away from Earth. It lies just at the edge of the planet's inner rings. The newly found object is estimated to only be 6 miles wide, less than the walking distance between the city halls of Phoenix and Tempe. It's so small it was not visible to the Voyager 2 spacecraft that flew by Uranus in the mid-80s. Mariam El-Motamid is a scientist at the Southwest Research Institute and study author.
It is dark. It is faint. It is not very bright, suggesting that it is not only water ice, because if it's only water ice, it will be very bright.
The moon is unnamed, but Uranus's other satellites are named after Shakespeare characters like Juliet. El-Motamid says she'll also propose a name from the bard. Greg Haney, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now, one of the exclusive elements of KJZZ's The Show. It's called Soapbox, where we turn over the mic to listeners. Each season has unique voices sharing on a single theme. Here's the latest Soapbox.
We all misbehave once in a while, even the teacher's pet. Here's Amber Victoria Singer with the latest essay in our Soapbox series.
I am not a troublemaker. Well, I wasn't one in high school, anyway. My hand was so often the first in the air to answer a question that teachers would say, "How about we hear from someone else?" My senior year, I was dress-coded for the first and only time in my four-year high school career. On that particular day, I was wearing a t-shirt tucked into cut-off denim shorts. The shorts were new. I had worn them to the beach a couple of times, but never to school. I underestimated how uncomfortable they would get as I sat in a plastic chair all day, and I was constantly adjusting them in between classes. At the end of lunch period on D-Day, dress code day, the bell rang, I threw my stuff in my backpack, and stood up. As I reached back instinctively to pull down my shorts, someone tapped my shoulder. "You," front office now. The voice behind me belonged to a new staff member who was cracking down hard on dress code violations. I was marched to the front office, past the large room where my next class was filing in. It felt like literally everyone was watching my walk of shame. The adult who dress-coded me held out a pair of red PE shorts. My cheeks burned as I looked at myself in the bathroom mirror. I felt stupid and angry. It wasn't fair that I was missing class because some random lady decided my shorts were too short. Why did she get to decide what was or wasn't appropriate? I held back tears as I came out of the bathroom. The truth is, I knew my shorts were probably too short. I had pulled them down so much throughout the day it had become a mindless habit. But I was supposed to be doing a presentation in class, and I would have rather died than stand up in front of everyone in a pair of basketball shorts with dress code written across the leg. I would not be going down without a fight. I demanded to see exactly what rule in the student handbook I broke, which led to a trip to the vice principal's office. Mr. D pulled out the dress code rules and pointed at number 5. Shorts or skirts must cover the student's entire backside. After a little more debate, Mr. D agreed to let me change back into my jean shorts so he could see for himself. I pulled them down as much as I could before walking back into his office. I turned around slowly so he could see the back. As I walked back to class in my previously too short shorts, I tried to make sense of what I was feeling. Triumph, because I got my way. Discomfort, because two grown adults had just spent what felt like an eternity deciding if enough of my backside was covered. Rage, because what I was wearing resulted in me missing 25 minutes of my advanced humanities class. The embarrassment over the whole dress code debacle hurt more than the world-class wedgie my shorts had been giving me all day. When I got home that evening, I shoved them far into the back of my bottom dresser drawer. I never wore them again.
That was Amber Victoria Singer, who eventually graduated high school and went on to become a producer for the show, where she's never been dress-coded. Hear more of our soapbox essays at kjzz.org.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Bridget Dowd. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more online and on the KJZZ mobile app.